All right, well, good evening, everyone. It's good to be with you again this evening. Good to be able to study. Good to be able to finally reach the last lesson of Genesis. This is not the last class period on Genesis. This is simply the last lesson. 50 chapters broken up into 20 lessons takes a while. My good friend Nathan Peeler, who still preaches down in Florida, when I started this class and organizing it, and I asked him, how long is it going to take? He goes, oh, about a year. Now I get it. Of course, we've done a little better, perhaps. But we're in chapter 47, around verse 28. Seems to be the best place to sort of divide up that section. In chapter 47, we've talked about, most recently, about Joseph's interaction with the Egyptians. And how Joseph really served as a sort of a benevolent leader. He's a person who's been taking care of them, rather than taking advantage of them, as far as the Egyptians go. But the way it works out, because of the famine, all of Egypt winds up belonging to Pharaoh, more than just control. The land itself belonged to Pharaoh, along with the people. That was with the exclusion of the priestly class. But it was not so for Israel. What happened with them over this course of time? Yeah, they did the other thing. They prospered. Their land wasn't beholden to the Pharaoh. They didn't sell their territory to Pharaoh. Or at least it doesn't say that they did. It says, on the other hand, you look at verse 27, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it, and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. I think the situation in Goshen is very different, or at least very much better than it was for the Egyptians. But in verse 29, we kind of begin the decline, or it's the beginning of the end for Jacob. And there are lots of things that need to be taken care of in these last few chapters. This last section of Genesis, you remember Genesis is divided into how many sections? Any fingers you have? 10. Okay, unless you're my grandpa, you have 8.5. Okay. But if you're normal, have 10 fingers. Okay. There are 10 divisions in the book of Genesis. Okay. They're called the books of the generations of certain people. Okay. What's the 10th one? The last most important person in Genesis? It's Jacob. All right. These are the generations of Jacob. That's actually the opening line to the chapter that introduces Joseph. We're still in that book. The end of Genesis is about Jacob. And we've talked about it before. The reason why we talk so much about Joseph, we have to explain why Jacob is in Egypt. And to tell that story, you have to tell Joseph's story. But we're telling the story of Jacob. So the book comes back around to focus on him. When it comes near that Israel must die in verse 29, what does he request from his son Joseph? Do not bury me here. Rather, do what? Someone else. Take me back to Canaan. Okay, take my bones back to Canaan. Did you notice that Jacob made Joseph swear in a real peculiar way? Yeah, that expression, put the hand under the thigh. Okay. There's some debate as to exactly what that means as far as particulars go, but we know exactly the intent of it. When was the last time we heard that expression? Someone hand under the thigh and made them swear to do something. It's happened before. What's that? Not in that case, although there was a promise made, but not that expression of the hand under the thigh and swearing that something would have to happen. That was a promise. I don't think the expression used. The last time I can remember, Abraham makes his servant swear to go to Padan Aram and to get a wife for his son Isaac. All right. But it's that same sort of very serious thing. If I'm wrong about that, please feel free to jump in. But anytime you see that expression, this is not the only time you're going to see it in the Bible. It happens again later. It's a very serious thing. Swear to take his bones up out of the land of Egypt. Verse 30, rather, let me lie with my fathers. Bury me in their burying place. Where's that? By the trees of Mamre, it's the cave of Machpelah. Okay. What's that? Or Machpelah. That's probably better as Machpelah. That sounds right. Why do we know that place so well? Remember why? Abraham bought it from the Hittites. Okay, on what occasion? Sarah died. Okay, Sarah died. He needed a burying place, and so there's that conversation between him. Who all's buried there so far? Abraham. Well, Sarah. Okay. Isaac. Abraham. Anybody else connected to Isaac? Rebecca. Leah. Okay, there's only five there so far. Rachel is actually not buried there. She's buried in Bethlehem, which is kind of on the way there. It's an interesting dynamic. Rachel's the favored one, but Leah's the actual first wife. She gets the honor. She gets the firstborn children. She gets the cave at the end. Interesting thing to look at.
Why did Jacob care?
That he was buried there? I think he realizes the promise. Yeah. It's kind of like I heard someone say he's not around to worry about it, you know? Well, if you think about it, they don't own any land in Egypt. Right? It's been given to them to live there, but it's not theirs necessarily. That cave in its place represents the one spot they own, you know, in Canaan. So I think that has something to do with it. They want to be buried on my land. That's the only place they have. He's been told they'll come out. So he promises Joseph, when we come out, bring the bones out. He doesn't know when, but he does know it's going to happen. At the end of the book, Joseph's going to request the same thing. Okay, that he and his father both be carried out. At the end of verse 31, how does it read in your Bible? The last sentence of chapter 47. Where do we see that expression elsewhere? It's in your New Testament, actually. It's in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, in the chapter of faith. The section that's mentioned about Jacob in Hebrews 11, okay, maybe just valuable just to read that to refresh your memory. That expression that the Hebrew writer uses, for he bowed upon the head of his staff, or upon the head of his bed, depending on how your Bible reads. Chapter 11, verse 21 in Hebrews. And by faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. Okay, so he does it here, and he does it also after the blessing. It can be head, it can be staff. The word of itself just means the top of something, like the top of the bed or the top of the staff. Either one would work. But the fact that Jacob's an old man, and he's making his son swear to bring his bones out because he knows Israel's going to be delivered from Egypt. And he's worshiping here at the end of his life. Okay, I think those are good indicators for his spiritual condition. Okay, he realizes there's a promise, and he's also worshiping there at the end. I think he's to be commended for that. One other reference to that sort of thing, in 1 Kings 1, David, when he's basically on his deathbed, offers a prayer of thanksgiving to God, and he does the same thing, actually. He bows on the edge of his bed and worships. So you see that sort of thing happening later on. Okay, last and final thoughts before chapter 48. All right. You ever wonder why Genesis is written out of order? sometimes? Because we get to here to the end of chapter 47, the time draws near that Israel must die, but we gotta do a bunch of stuff first. We gotta go through the promise to bring the bones out, we've gotta bless Ephraim and Manasseh, we've gotta pronounce all the individual blessings. There's a lot that still has to be gone through. And here at the beginning of chapter 48, who is being blessed? Alright, Ephraim and Manasseh, and someone else. Who are they again? Joseph's sons. Okay, what do their names mean? Oh, you'll have to cheat. If you turn back a couple pages, it's written there. Chapter 41, beginning in verse 51. All right, Manasseh is the idea of you can forget all of his hardship, all of his troubles. And Ephraim. It's like the... Yeah. He's fruitful in the land of his affliction. Ephraim comes from the Hebrew sounding word for being fruitful. Would actually work out to be what their tribe would do, but that's a little bit later in the story. Joseph was told that the father was ill, so he brings him Ephraim and Manasseh in order to be blessed. A couple of similarities to some earlier things we read about Isaac. When it came time for Isaac to die, what did he do? Or he thought he was near death. Same thing, okay? Time's coming close, I need to bless my children. So you get this same sort of thing. Some other parallels. Jacob's eyes were dim. Same thing is said of Isaac when the blessings are going to be pronounced. When Isaac is near to death, who does he call to bless? He calls Esau. He calls the favored son in order to bless him. And now here at the end of Jacob's life, he calls the favored son in order to bless his children. On who does the blessing fall, the younger or the older? Younger. Sounds familiar. Just like Isaac and his two sons. Whereas Isaac was fooled into it, Jacob does so willingly. We'll talk a little bit more about it. Also, I think it's an interesting parallel. Someone's unhappy about the deal. Yeah. Joseph is not happy about what's happened. In the same way Esau was rather unhappy. Rebekah too, about what was about to happen. But there are some notable contrasts. Jacob is looking to carry out God's plan rather than defy it. Okay, earlier in the book, in chapter 25, Jacob is trying to circumvent God's plan, or what he thinks is God's plan, and here he's actually trying to work with it. There's no deceit in this section. It's simply Jacob doing what the Lord wanted, and he's acting in full knowledge of this. How old are Ephraim and Manasseh around this time, do you suppose? What's that? How old are Ephraim and Manasseh? How old are the two sons at this point, do you suppose? Not very, okay. Right.
17 plus.
Yeah, they were born within that first year of him taking power. The expression between his knees, I'm not sure that it's a literal one. I don't really know quite what it means. If you look at the dates, it works out that they're about 19 or 20. Somewhere in that range. So whether they're bowed in front of him, I'm not sure. But they definitely both bow, and they're both old enough to be blessed, so there's that. What's that? Yeah. I think that between the knees is like an expression. You know, like they have, hopefully, if they're 20 years old, you know, you got them, you know, up on the lap. But they're somewhere around that age, just based on the dates. I want you to see something though. Jacob knows what he's going to do. He didn't suddenly, all of a sudden, surprise, oh wait, I crossed my hands. He knows already what he's going to do. Read verse 5. He says, "And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine." What order does he say their name? Ephraim and Manasseh. That's not age. That's backwards. Even in the early stages, he knew full well what he was going to do. And he reverses them. Why does the blessing of the birthright fall all the way to these two? Seems like there are a lot of people in line, but in front of these two guys. Right? Joseph's. Yep, Joseph's the oldest of Rachel. Okay. Why wouldn't we give it to Reuben or Simeon or Levi? We get to chapter 49, we find out why a lot of the blessings fell all the way to Judah. And even some of those that would go to them have gone to the favored son. Judah is still going to be the leader among the tribes, but you read 1 Chronicles 5, it says clearly Joseph was given the birthright that should have gone to these other two. Verse 7 is sort of a sad moment. He's telling this story, okay, he's going to take the two sons for the inheritance. He says in verse 7, "As for me, when I came from Padan, to my sorrow Rachel died in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem." Why mention her in this context? What's that? It's Joseph's mother. These are the grandkids. I almost see this as a, you know, wishes she was here type thing. You know. But as for Rachel, you know, she died before she could see what all had been brought about. Joseph gives credit to God for his two sons in verse 9, which is par for the course when it comes to Joseph. He does that typically. He gives God the credit. Verses 11 and 12. The children are brought that they could be blessed. Israel says to Joseph, verse 11, "I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your offspring also. I never expected to see you alive, and instead of that, I've gotten to see you and your children." What's the very next thing that happens? They thank God. It's not just thank you, but what do? Someone else. Bow down and worship. Can you think of a more appropriate response to such an amazing blessing than to immediately fall down and start worshiping? You know, immediately fall down and give God credit for what He's done. And overwhelmingly, the way His blessings have been brought. I see that as so appropriate, what happens in verse 12. Before they get on with the blessing process, let's bow and worship. Let's thank God for what He's done. That's a good lesson for Israel and for us, I think. And then you get to the unexpected part of the story. Joseph takes them both. Joseph understands what's supposed to happen. Manasseh is put towards the right hand, Ephraim towards the left hand. Jacob does the old switcheroo, puts the hands on opposite heads. Joseph's not very happy about it. What does Jacob say? I love this in verse 19. The ESV, I don't know if it's just poetic license, but the ESV just says, "I know, my son, I know." It's kind of like, I know. I know what you're thinking. I know what you expect. This is not the way it's going to be. The younger is going to be blessed more than the older. That's been such a consistent theme throughout Genesis. Well, Joseph tries to correct him, and he says, no. I mean, he knows what's going on. You know, he may not be able to see well, but he understands what's supposed to happen. Jacob sort of objects to this, and Joseph objects, and Jacob says, "No, I don't think so." The blessing that's pronounced in verses 15 and 16 is really beautiful. three times Jacob refers to God. He says, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. Think about Jacob's life. Don't all those have connections within his life? The God of his fathers. He often refers to his fathers and the God of his fathers. The God who's been my shepherd all my life to this day. Jacob's the sheep that keeps running away. One that needs a lot of shepherding. And what about that third one? The angel who's redeemed me from all evil. How would that connect in Jacob's life? Do you think of any stories with Jacob and an angel? Jacob wrestles with a man until dawn. I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. After he gets done with this, he says, I've seen God and lived. Of course, it wasn't God in his full power, some representation of it, but I almost see Jacob remembering this event towards the end of his life. He asks that the boys be blessed. In them let my name be carried on in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. We wouldn't normally call this a blessing. We would have a different word for it. We don't normally pronounce a blessing, but we do something else that's quite similar. Starts with a P. Prayer. If you look at that, it's in the form of a prayer, right? Because who's the one that's going to carry these things out? It's God, right? This is according to God's will. If God will, these things happen. You know, maybe we think about blessing in that sense. It's not a set of magic words. It's asking for God's aid and assistance and you know, intervention in the specific area. He's asking that the boys be blessed. And I think that's interesting to see. That's what mine says in the ESV. I was going to look at the New American Standard real quickly. Same thing. The fact that he says it three times, he refers to someone three times, and the first two is God, I tend to think the third one's probably a reference to God also. Does it really? That would be even... Capitalization is sort of up to the interpreter, because they didn't do capital letters in Hebrew, but... if they think it's God, typically they'll uppercase it. So that might be some indication that they think it's the same. You're saying the same thing three times. Just slightly different ways of saying God, right? God of my fathers, God who's my shepherd, God who's redeemed me from all evil. It fits the description of God. He's asking that God bless these two boys. Ephraim is put before Manasseh. This is exactly the way it would work out when they become tribes. Actually, Manasseh would be quite large, but Ephraim would be the more powerful one. Definitely economically better off. Yes, sir. You get those, they happen a lot in Genesis. The three men that come up to Abraham under the tree. Two of them walk away and then Abraham's talking with the Lord. So the third one must have been the Lord or some representation of him, you know. The angel cries out to Hagar, but then the Lord speaks to her. You know, you get that sort of that back and forth. I think it's certainly a reference to God here in verse 16. Alright, chapter 48 and verse 21, Israel says to Joseph, behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you rather than your brothers one mountain slope that I took from the hand of the Amorites with my sword and with my bow. Some translations might have the word Shechem there. I don't think it means the city of Shechem. I think it refers to like a tract of land or a ridge in that area. I don't think it's the city, personally, but I could be wrong about that. Similar sounding sound. It's just, it sort of sounds like the same place. Is the only thing I could really find about it. All right. Anything Israel, anything the reader, the listener to this for the first time needs to take away from it? You're an Israelite. You're hearing all this for the first time. What do you draw from it? Maybe a lesson you've drawn out already. Thank God for your blessings. Absolutely right. And when you thank, be appreciative, recognize what God has done for you, and then demonstrate, you know, show that. More than just, I'm not saying the quick thank you is wrong, but if that's all we ever do, then, you know, we need to be more thankful, more expressive of that. They fall down and worship right there in the middle of this whole thing they're doing. I think that's... doesn't know when or how, but he's certain that's going to happen. And then you're an Israelite hearing this on the other side, thinking, yep, it happened. If you're an Israelite, you are carrying around the bones of these two people. And their descendants are you. And now you're in the process of going to that land. You know, God's faithfulness is demonstrated again. What could Israel learn from this whole right hand, left hand switching and then Jacob refusing to change his mind business?
God has a way.
And that may not match your way. That probably doesn't match what you have in mind. But rather than try to change it, just, you know, you have to be okay with it. This is the way it needs to be. And if it's God's way, then so be it. Israel would need to learn that lesson. And so do we. We need to learn it ourselves. I need to learn it. Yeah, God has a plan in mind, and He is not beholden to us to let us know what it is or why. Sometimes He does. It's not His responsibility to us. Alright, beginning in verse 49, what is this next section? What is it about? Chapter 49, I'm sorry. Alright. That first phrase you see in verse, oh, never mind. Let's go to our questions. I forgot about those. I always do. The questions that we had leading up to this section, make sure we're good on those. What promise does Moses make sure the audience hears throughout Genesis? And you hear it a couple of times in this chapter. And what's going to happen to them? They're going to be made a big multitude, all right? And you're coming out and you're going to Canaan. All right? Remember, you're an Israelite. You're in the process of heading to that place. And now here again in your story, you're going to be brought out. You're headed there. You're going to Canaan. Not only that, when I die, take my bones and go bury them in Canaan. It's one thing to tell the future. It's another thing to make plans, you know, to like set a date in the future and say, go do this whenever you get there. That takes commitment. When you get to Canaan, I've given you this piece of land that's mine. That's concrete. You know, they really genuinely expected this to happen. All right, next. What did Jacob do with the two of those people? He adopted them as his own, gave them the birthright in Joseph's place, you might say. And he blessed the younger one more than he did the older one. He repeated what had happened with him and Esau. And in a way, what had happened with Isaac and Ishmael, because Ishmael is technically older. All right, number three. How is this an echo of earlier stories in Genesis? Anything in this story remind you of old stories in Genesis? The thing. just put a box on that, what you just said. You know, that's the button you push for Bible class. You have lots of similarities. You have the younger being blessed over the older. You have Isaac's condition. Okay, kind of the circumstances around how he's doing and why he's choosing to bless them. I mean, all sorts of references backwards in the story. I was talking to Bill about this one day. Genesis is one of those books where the best commentary for Genesis is Genesis, because there's nothing, you can't look after it to figure it out, right? Whatever you need to know is somewhere backwards. That's what makes Revelation so hard. You got the rest of the Bible to filter it through. But some of those things you see. Okay, and in the beginning of chapter 49, there's this phrase, that I may tell you what shall happen in days to come. So who's the audience for this? Who's it meant for? It's meant for the Israelites, but is it meant for these people that's actually hearing it for the first time? Yeah. The hearers of this, the 12 sons, this is about them, but it's not really for them. It's for way later. Right? In some cases, hundreds of years down the road. Here are the things that are going to happen to you. There's a lot in this last section of Genesis about things that happen in the future. It's a lot of forward-looking things here. And here in chapter 49, you get these blessings. Is this the first time we've had an oracle pronounced for the sons of a great man in Genesis? When does it happen before? No, not Melchizedek. Right. When was the last time someone in Genesis had more than two sons and pronounced his will towards them? Before Isaac. Noah. Noah's the last time this sort of thing happened. After the flood, after the incident with Ham, you remember, Noah sits down and he goes, here's what's going to happen. Okay, Ham is going to serve Japheth and Shem. They're going to go and be this thing, be that thing. That's what Jacob starts to pronounce here for his sons. I think that's what's happened.
Yeah, and you know, to me, I think we have a lot of social conventions. A bunch of them. Mm-hmm. Most of our life, social conventions, we think that as opposed to something that we have as a law of God. I think this is the case where you can make this argument. God's will and pattern overrules any social conventions, no matter how well established or time on.
I think when it was established outside of the text, the Bible doesn't tell us when or how, but that's what makes the story of the patriarch so strange, is that almost at every turn, the younger is blessed above the older, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. You know, almost like God saying, this is how I want it, and you're going to see proof of that as you go along. You know, that I'm not going to bless the oldest one like everyone expects. I'm going to do things differently. Believe so, yes. But he was supposed to. It's commonly, he was supposed to have it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking the beginning of it may have just been practical, you know. When the father dies, who is best equipped to take over the land and animals? It may well be just the oldest one. You know? I don't know. It may have grown just from necessity, like most things. We don't have time, obviously, to get to many of the blessings themselves. Although one thing I will have you look at, we're not going to read these individually, but just scan over the chapter. Who has more text written about them than anyone else? Or who are the big players in this chapter, you might say? Judah has a ton written about him, and Joseph by way of Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, just from the sense of who is going to be important coming up here soon, that is an indicator just to itself. Okay. Lot is written about Judah. Much is written about Judah and much is written about Joseph and Ephraim. Ephraim and Manasseh. And that's how it would play out in their history. Those are the big players. When you go read through the prophets, the name for the southern kingdom is nearly always Judah, sometimes Benjamin, but almost always Judah. Who is the most common name for the northern tribes? Outside of just the word Israel. It's Ephraim. Ephraim is used as a short name for the northern tribes many, many, many times. So just notice that when you go back and you go through chapter 49, just notice who has the most written about him. That tells you a little something. Okay, we'll begin 49, Lord willing, next week. The material on Exodus is